This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. Today we're going to talk about environmental policymaking in a democracy, a topic that is receiving a lot of attention now with the fires in California, a recent federal report on the dire concerns about our environment, and a new conference that's just opened in Poland with most of the major countries in the world, excluding the United States in some respects. We have with us, I think, probably one of the best people in the world to talk about this topic with, my colleague and friend Sheila Olmsted. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning.
Sheila is a professor at the LBJ School. She's also served on the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House. She's taught at a number of universities and writes in particular about the intersection of economics and the environment, market conditions, and the ways in which markets work with and sometimes work against environmental policy with regard to water and various other resources. Before we turn to that discussion, though, we have another poem from Zachary. Zachary, what's the title of your poem this morning?
It's called So Fluorescently Away.
Okay, let's hear it.
I look out the window waking up at night, hold tight to my teddy bears, watch the white wind whistle against the electric poles, can see the green wilderness beyond along a sewage creek. I can feel the smell of the night creep in among the asphalt, can remember the cold water in the bathroom and my parched tongue. I can still hear the BBC echo through my ears, the wildfire sirens, earthquake images from decades ago flip like a slideshow through my mind. Sleeping and awake in the cold silence, warming under my blankets as the globe slips through the universe. And all oceans are all clear to me now. All the forested tundra frozen grassland land, it creeps, seeps like sleep into the clearing image of a globe. And I am awakened, it seems like only a few minutes later, by hard footsteps up the stairs, a jolt of the electric light. And I walk into the school under the fluorescence. And when I close my eyes, I can see the globe slipping so fluorescently away.
Well, that's a great image, Zachary. What is your message about the environment in your poem?
That we see it in our everyday lives, and we see the environment all around us, but we have trouble seeing the whole picture and seeing what's happening to our globe. And when we do see it, we just want to look away and not look at it.
Wow. Well, that's a perfect point to transition to Sheila here. Why do we have such trouble with environmental policy? Everyone seems to care about having clean air and having nice parks, but yet we seem stuck. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I guess I would open by saying maybe to strike a little bit of a positive note and say that we've actually achieved just tremendous progress in the United States and even in countries like China, right, where, population has pushed really hard for better and more air quality regulation due to really significant pollution problems, especially in the cities. You know, if you think about where we were in the 1970s in the U.S., you know, air quality on the whole in U.S. cities was just so much worse than it is today. So we've made a huge amount of progress. But I think some of what Zachary's pointing to in his poem and some of what you're asking about has to do with climate change, which is the kind of mother of all environmental problems. You know, and one could take a pessimistic view and say, well, if we can't do something about that, then, you know, why talk about the progress we've made in other areas? And I would say, in a way, right, it's true to focus on that as something that's different and definitely harder than some of these other things that we've tackled. You know, the first president to ask for a report on climate change essentially was LBJ. We're talking 1965.
Right,
you know,
right.
He made a speech to Congress and he mentioned it. You know, we've known about it since the late 1800s. There were Swedish chemists, you know, that kind of worked out essentially the basic, you know, physics and atmospheric chemistry behind the problem. So it's true. We've known for a long time. It's a very hard problem to solve. And I would say largely that's because this is really a global problem. We could really do a lot to fix air quality in Los Angeles in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s by doing things internally, you know, within the United States and even just within the state of California to some extent. But this problem of climate change is something that essentially all countries have to kind of band together to do something about. And even though we've had this global process in place since 1992 with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the meeting that you were talking about today, it's one of many, many, you know, global meetings that have taken place. It's just a really thorny problem to solve when essentially everybody has to work together to do it.
Right. And just to get it out there, how do we know climate change is occurring?
Well, we know climate change is occurring for a lot of reasons. Even if you go back to the sort of basic predictions in the 1890s, right, by the original folks who thought about this in the physical sciences, a lot of what they've predicted has come to pass. Obviously, there's lots of uncertainty, but generally the idea, right, is that we are emitting lots of gases that have this kind of greenhouse effect, right, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And when we increase the stock of those gases in the upper atmosphere of the Earth, when the sun's radiation comes in, less of it escapes, and so we have this general warming trend. And we know that that's happened because we've tracked for many decades now both the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide as well as global surface temperatures worldwide. And we can see this signal, you know, quite clearly of human-induced warming since the mid-1800s, since industrialization, in that data in lots and lots of places. The most famous, and so maybe the most well-known because it's been tracked the longest, is the Mauna Loa Observatory data, right, which has this sort of famous graph, right, showing this increase. And other things are consistent with that. We see increased acidification of oceans and freshwater resources. We see other things that are consistent with the story of that kind of human-induced warming, like more severe storms, more frequent downpours in some parts of the world, and so on, longer and more severe droughts, and so on. And as scientists get better and better at what's called attribution science, really taking these kind of individual events like the California drought or Hurricane Harvey or Superstorm Sandy, and kind of working out the probability that these events would have been that severe in the absence of human-induced warming, and finding that that probability is really, really small, we get better at saying what specifically, right, are the current results of that warming trend, and then also better at predicting, you know, what might happen in the future.
So if it is so obvious, and there are still some who deny, but if it's so obvious, why doesn't that mobilize global action? Why is it so hard?
Well, it's a great question. I think it almost, my answer has two parts. I mean, one is that we actually do see it mobilizing a lot of action. I think one reason it's hard is because one could argue that until fairly recently, lots of Americans, lots of, you know, kind of citizens in other parts of the world may not have felt the impacts of that warming directly, right, in their local communities, in their households, in their firms, right, if we're talking about people running businesses. But since about half of the warming that has occurred since the mid-1800s, late 1800s, has occurred since 1990, we've seen in recent decades this very rapid sort of series of changes where people are now, they find it perceptible, right, that the winters are, we're just not getting as much snow, or we're getting, you know, the winters are warmer, right, you know, we're seeing seasons change earlier.
Right, bigger hurricanes.
Bigger hurricanes, right. So when we see these kinds of effects, that's when we start to, right, that people start to feel those things, then it, you know, in some ways we see more action. And even though it's true that we've seen at the U.S. federal level, you know, perhaps less action than some people would have wanted since the political change in 2016 when President Obama left office and President Trump came into office, we certainly have seen a continuation at the local level, at the state level, right? There's sort of lots of you know, there's this "we're still in" movement, right? Even though the United States has announced its intention to withdraw from the Paris Accords in 2020, when it's possible for us to do that, still lots of folks that are taking action, even within the United States. I mean, the state of California is kind of your classic example,
right.
And you could say, "Oh, California, right? They're always kind of ahead of the curve on these environmental issues," and one might write that off. But I think it's very hard to write off, first of all, the scale of the attempts that California is making and the ambition of those attempts, and then also the fact that it's not just California.
Right.
Right. Lots of places, lots of cities around the U.S., exactly, that are taking significant measures, costly measures, right, to try to make a dent in this problem.
And how does it make a difference? Because oftentimes people will say to me, well, it's nice to do these small things, but if the world is, you know, warming
know,
up around us, what difference will it make?
Well, you know, it's funny because, again, as an economist, you know, maybe if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have given you exactly that answer. I would have said, it's a drop in the bucket.
Right.
You know, it's really hard to be positive, right, about those kinds of measures when I know the scale of the problem and that it really takes, right, if we don't tackle, you know, seriously emissions from countries like China and the United States, right, that going forward we're in real trouble. But then what you see is collectively, right, it's actually quite impressive. I mean, it's nothing an economist would have predicted, right? You know, we think about game theory and strategic interaction, and political scientists think about this too. And I think it's very hard with our usual models to explain why, right, this incredible kind of flourishing of local efforts has happened. And also to note that, you know, when you add them up, there's something there, right, that, you know, it's not ideal, a bottom-up approach to a problem that's global in scale and that really needs to be tackled at the global level. But I think you can also see it as kind of the beginning of a big wave that might just crash right over, right, the you know, the national efforts and prompt more and more serious,
right,
you know, national efforts. I feel like I'm positive about that in the United States. I mean, I wish it weren't so late in a way.
Right.
And I think another way of thinking about it is, you know, I've shifted a significant amount of my own research toward worrying about adaptation, right? Mm-hmm. If we know that, for example, the next few decades of warming are essentially kind of baked in, right, because of the long-lasting nature of these emissions in the upper atmosphere, then what can we do now, right, to kind of help populations that are vulnerable to adapt to the changes that are likely to take place, mm-hmm. and at the same time still worrying, right, and about and trying to enact change,
right,
in terms of emissions.
So it's a kind of dual approach. We have to try to limit the damage, but also learn to live with some
sure.
of the damages.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, you know, you have to think about it as cheap insurance in a way. It's not cheap, right? But,
no.
but it is insurance, right? Really thinking about, you know, what we can do to help people who are going to be strongly affected and don't have a lot of recourse. And some of these recent events like the droughts and the hurricanes and so on are really good examples. When you look at a Hurricane Harvey, you know, and you think about the populations that were most seriously affected and continue to be most seriously affected by being displaced from mm-hmm. homes and mm-hmm. And so on. We can do a lot policy-wise, right, that in a way has nothing to do with climate change, right? We don't all have to agree mm-hmm. about what's causing mm-hmm. it or anything like that to, you know, to look at this projections of what's going to happen to storms and, you know,
right.
in coastal Texas and think about how we help people prepare
right.
for that.
Right. How do we deal with the local inequalities? And this is something else you're obviously an expert on. Climate change tends to affect those in poorer communities most of all because
yeah.
they're most vulnerable. And then when we ask for adaptation,
mm-hmm.
the costs are often highest
yeah.
For them. This happens at the global scale. It's why the Indians criticize quite often
sure.
American claims on these issues. And it happens within cities like Austin, if you
yeah.
look at what the cost of recycling is and how people deal with that in different parts of the city. So
yeah.
how do we think about that?
It's a really tough one. I mean, here again, right, there's a political process that determines those, you know, the outcomes of those kinds of distributional arguments. And, you know, you know, when I talk to my own kids, I say, you vote, right? You think carefully about these things, you vote, and you do more than vote, right? You really get out there and you try and talk to people in a reasonable way. And again, we can all, you know, reasonable people, you know, can disagree about lots of things, but we can still sit down and have, you know, a conversation about how one helps those folks. At the end of the day, I think a lot of the discussions are about adaptation and about vulnerability to global change is very similar to conversations we have about vulnerability more generally.
Mm.
And there's, you know, some things that are qualitatively different. You know, for example, a lot of this has to do with uncertainty and exposure to these really, you know, kind of highly unlikely but catastrophic events like a Harvey. And so the nature of that conversation maybe is somewhat different than, you know, day-to-day difficulty of being a low-income household or a household with someone who's disabled, right, or has health issues. But at the same time, you know, there's plenty of evidence showing that, you know, people with higher incomes, people that are in more economically secure positions are also more resilient to those kinds of shocks.
Sure.
That's true, like you said, you know, whether we're in, you know, suburban Houston or whether we're in, you know, a developing country where the weather shocks are quite different in nature, but is going to have the same kind of unpredictable and negative impact on households. And so the more we can do, right, to vote and for lobby for policies that help shore up those kinds of mm-hmm. households in other ways, mm-hmm. the better off they'll be mm-hmm. for with climate change as well.
Are you also optimistic, as many of my students are, about how technologies can help us to
Absolutely.
Alleviate some of these inequalities?
Oh, right? We've seen so much of that already. I mean, that's one of the things that makes it fascinating from an economic perspective as to why we're kind of in this boat of, you know, denial and you know, kind of foot dragging on doing something. Really, there's been a sea change in the cost of some really important technologies, things like renewable energy sources mm-hmm. like solar and wind energy, which has dropped dramatically over the past few decades in ways that people could not have predicted. Even the fracking, the sort of shale gas boom, I mean, there are upsides and downsides to that, but one big upside is that natural gas is a lot cleaner, not perfectly clean, but a lot cleaner than something like coal when
sure.
we think about using it to generate electricity. And so just those two things, right, the phenomenal drops in the cost of those kinds of resources have made it easier than it ever might have been, you know, than we might have predicted a few decades ago to reduce emissions and to make this kind of transition to lower carbon energy sources. So we know that that works. We know that technology and technological change are critical pieces of the picture. The cheaper we can make it to control emissions and to adapt and so on, the better off we'll be. And we know the kinds of policies that we need to choose, right to put in place to encourage those kinds of innovations. Right. So I think that's a real positive positive aspect to this as well.
I guess that brings us back to the question of what to do now, right?
Yeah.
And so many young people come to me and they express enthusiasm for getting involved in these environmental organizations and movements, but such profound frustration that as the enthusiasm has risen, the resistance seems to have risen at least equally as much, right?
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, what I would say is I think, you know, a lot of us are joiners and we really enjoy, you know, kind of joining groups where we are, you know, talking with other folks who feel the same way that we do. And that's a wonderful thing in life, right, is finding folks who are of like mind. But I think at this point, you know, having conversations, those really difficult conversations with people who are not of like mind is actually even more important. Mm. I mean, for our own kind of pleasure and sanity and enjoyment, we like to kind of gather with folks, right, that we agree with. But there are some really good scientists, I think about like Catherine Hayhoe at Texas Tech and others, who have done an excellent job really trying to engage, you know, folks who are maybe less amenable at first glance to both thinking about climate change as a serious problem and to thinking about policies that would actually help us mitigate and adapt.
So how do you do that?
Yeah.
It's so hard to get out of our settings. I had an argument with a very generous donor to the university a few months ago who was upset we didn't have climate deniers at a conference at the university.
Interesting.
You know, on the one hand, we want to talk to other people.
Absolutely.
But we also don't want to talk to people who deny science.
Yeah,
right?
No, absolutely. It's a huge challenge, right? This is an academic institution. And I think you can set your boundary and just explain to people, right? It's not, I hear people say, you know, I don't believe in climate change. And I say, well, it's not a religion, right? There's a really long, as I described earlier, very long scientific record here mm-hmm. that we can look to. You know, obviously it's often difficult, you know, to predict, you know, things in really tight ways, right? But the general premise, you know, is there and is very well founded. So I think it's important to have that conversation. But again, even if you can't make progress on that front, you know, we still can look at the data, say, over the past decade, and folks, even folks who are not necessarily amenable to the argument that humans are causing this warming, are clearly, right, in many cases, amenable to a discussion about what they're observing, right? Their weather, what they see. Farmers in the middle of the country, right, are clearly in this boat. You know, people, residents of coastal cities, residents of California who are experiencing year-long fire seasons, which, you know, larger and more intense fires. So I think that's where we find the common ground is, okay, even if we can't agree necessarily on what the causes are, right, let's talk about what's happening, what you observe, and how that's affecting your family or your business, and then go from there.
So what is, because we want to be optimistic, and there are many good reasons to be optimistic, what are the most positive things that young people can do? Obviously talking to others.
Yeah.
But how? What are the settings that we should create for that? And how can this sort of grassroots enthusiasm really continue to pick up momentum?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I would say, in addition to voting and taking part in elections, obviously we've just had a midterm election in 2 years. We'll have another important national election coming up. That's important. Activity at your local level, right? So cities have policies, as we talked about before, right? We can engage at that level. Even just socially, right? Sort of one person at a time, right? Having those conversations, I think we can't deny how important that is going to be over time.
Well, one thing that I've been excited by, and I think you see this every day, are the ways in which our students become educators to others, right? And some of that is, as you said, talking to people, but some of that is in our daily activities, our habits, right? And there's no doubt that our generation, and then a generation younger than us, that they act in ways differently from those a generation or two older than us, right? And so I sometimes think about good habits.
Absolutely. So there, you know, there's something to that, right? This idea that, you know, the more we set examples about driving less or, right, setting the heat a degree lower, those kinds of things, the more we can sort of train ourselves and our kids and, right, their friends and so on in sort of ways of being that are maybe going to step a little bit less heavily on the planet. At the same time, you know, I think a lot of this has to do with incentives. And if we don't face the proper incentives, even people who are very well-intentioned have a hard time, right, sometimes with that discipline and making decisions, you know, that have a net benefit for the planet. So it's both. You know, I think certainly those habits are important, but there are also a lot of folks who have written about the fact that, you know, we can make ourselves feel good by, you know, walking an extra block to recycle an aluminum can. But, that, you know, how much difference does that really make? You know, maybe thinking more carefully about what we can do with a grander
scale. We walk
that extra
block, but have two plastic bottles.
Right, exactly, exactly, exactly. We still have to think about voting. We still have to think about, you know, policy at a grander scale. And I do think individuals can, I mean, it's amazing, right, that we have, you know, a lawsuit in federal court, you know, by kids, right, you know, suing the federal government essentially for endangering their future, right, by not engaging in more significant climate mitigation. I mean, whether that goes anywhere or not, I think those, you know, there's just a wake-up call, right, that younger people have given to us old folks, and that I think is really useful.
And I think there's no substitute for having leaders in office who make this a priority, who understand, who are educated, and also prioritize. And that's part of what you're getting at with elections.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's fascinating is I think it's easy to think about, you know, sort of monolithic federal government that is now somehow suddenly opposed, right, to climate mitigation in a way that the prior federal administration wasn't. And I think that's a real mistake. I mean, it's a real mistake when you look at the National Climate Assessment that came out, you know, the day after Thanksgiving, and you realize that that's a culmination of work by hundreds of individuals and teams of individuals that have been building on, you know, work, as I mentioned, that's gone on for many decades. Many of those individuals are working within the federal government, and I'm not talking about a deep state, right? I'm talking about genuinely there are folks, even at the very highest levels, right, that don't necessarily agree with many of our, you know, our current president's choices, the choices he's made about policy, including things like withdrawing from Paris. So just having those conversations, getting trained, going into government service, being one of those folks that can have not a, you know, a screaming conversation, right, but a reasonable conversation about what the evidence is, why we think that, you know, economically, environmentally, that these are good ideas. And the more of that happens, right, eventually, I do think, right, that when change happens, right, when the window opens, we're ready with our convincing arguments, right? Not just our opinions, but our convincing arguments about why things need to change.
And people ready to step in. Young people ready to run for office or serve in these
things
public
change
roles.
On a dime. You know, we had a carbon tax proposal that was debated in the U.S. House, you know, right now. So that's, you know, you don't know exactly when those dramatic steps are going to take place. And so just be ready. And I think it can happen quickly.
That's a wonderful note to close on. Zachary, what do you think? Are you and your friends ready to step in? And is this an important issue for you?
I don't think there are any people my age really who deny that like recycling is a good thing to do and that it's better to walk and exercise than drive a car. And I think that they're ready to make a difference. But I'm not sure if they're ready to commit themselves fully because it's not much of a sacrifice to throw your aluminum can in a different bin than another one. But it's a whole different story when it comes to running for office or something like that.
Do you think your generation would vote for candidates who make this a priority?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we also saw it like last presidential election. Like there were a lot of candidates who were, at least on the Democratic side, who were prioritizing like environmental policy and placed that as one of their like most important issues.
And you're optimistic as well, Sheila.
I'm optimistic as well.
Well, thank you for joining us. I think this has been a fantastic conversation, Sheila and Zachary. And these are issues that we will continue to talk about. They are central to the future of our society. And that's why we've talked about them here on This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harrison Lemke, and you can find his music at harrisonlemke.com.
Subscribe and stay tuned for a new episode every Thursday featuring new perspectives on democracy.